On this episode of The Big Number, we take a deep look into how LeBron James is turning back the clock. We also take a trip around the rest of the NBA's major storylines, including our reactions to the Victor Wembanyama concussion. And we round out the show with the latest from MSG with my man, your man, our man, Dan Devine, who was in the building for the Hawks win over the Knicks. All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, I am joined by my man, your man, Dan Devine. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Tom. I felt compelled to get a haircut to kind of freshen up and try to like look a little younger for the postseason because, as it turns out, life doesn't have to end at 40. You know, you can still bring a youthful verve and joie de vivre to the postseason. And I think we saw a little bit more of that on Tuesday night.
Yeah, we did. How's your post-up game doing? I'm asking because I've got a big number about a certain 40-plus-year-old. So let's just get right into it. This week's big number is 16. That's the number of post-ups that LeBron James has had throughout this playoff so far. It's two games, 16 post-ups. That would lead all players and all teams. That's right. LeBron James has more post-ups than any team in the league in this postseason. So through two games, the guy is dialing back the clock. He's up 2-0 against Kevin Durant and the Houston Rockets in a time where they just need to extend this series or get past the Houston Rockets and potentially bridge the gap between now and when Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves, as J.J. Redick called it, my two big horses, they're not on the floor right now. And LeBron James, like, I'm going to slow this down. I'm going to make sure that I can extend these miles at 41 years old. He has 16 post-up plays, more than the Knicks at number two, more than the Boston Celtics, more than any team, the entire roster haven't posted up back to the basket as much as this guy has. And they've needed it. You know, when you talk about the way that they're operating their offense and trying to slow things down against this Houston Rockets defense, LeBron is surveying the floor and backing down guys who were, I mean, think about it this way. Tari Eason, he's backed him down for post-ups six times. Amen Thompson, five times. Jabari Smith Jr. a couple times, and Aaron Holiday has also gotten the business from LeBron James there on the post. But he's bullying them, and they can't really double, Dan, because he is surgical when it comes to throwing doubles at LeBron James. He's going to find the open man. He's done it a bunch of times in this postseason where if they throw two, three bodies at him, he's just going to pick you apart. And so J.J. Redick, hats off to him. The fact that he's been able to say, look, this isn't how we played all season long. But LeBron, with his back to the basket, able to control everybody like a marionette, he's been able to pick apart this defense. And think about it. Tari Eason is 24. Amen Thompson is 23. LeBron's been doing this for basically as long as they've been alive, right? And so Jabari Smith is like, remember that cute clip with Jabari? It was like, hey, remember you used to play with my dad, you know, and all this stuff? And he's like, watch what I'm about to do here. I am going to drill you into the basket, and I'm going to put this through the net, and you're going to do nothing about it. LeBron is insane. He is eternal. I don't understand it. LeBron, I covered LeBron in 2010 to 2014 in Miami, and I in a million years would I have never expected that at age 41, he'd be averaging 23 points, 10 assists, and 8 rebounds, and going up 2-0 against a bunch of 20-somethings. Yes, Kevin Durant's on the other side, but man, LeBron has been able to slow this down old school style, and it's a big reason why the Lakers are up 2-0. And you can say it at Luka and Austin Reeves, like, take your time. We got LeBron James here, and they don't.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you mentioned old school and the things that it made me think of. This is sort of like there's two checkpoints in this in my Rolodex here. One is you mentioned that the years in Miami that you were down there with the Heat Index, like this was the game he intended to build after that first disappointing finals, right? Like Dallas is guarding him with smaller guys, and he's not able to make hay out of it in the post. And so he goes into the lab that summer. He works with Akeem. He really focuses on that post game, comes back an entirely different animal that summer, into the 2012 season. So that, like, this is the result of that, right? The whole idea behind LeBron has to build out the post game is so that he can be the queen on the chessboard, put him anywhere on the floor, and he's going to be able to demand that attention and create the look. And then the other thing that it made me think of, particularly the slowdown that you mentioned, you've got here in our rundown that the pace of the series so far is 91.8 possessions per 48 minutes, the slowest of any matchup this postseason so far. And there's only been a handful of series that have been around that slow the last couple of years. And it's usually either a team that has like a dominant low post player like an Embiid or a Jokic or a LeBron, or a team that is like an underdog that needs to take the air out of the ball. And what that made me think of was right after LeBron left Miami, the 2015 NBA Finals, right? So for our Gen Z listeners, the younger folks out there that might not remember, or those who are way older and might need a jog of their memory, that's where his first year back in Cleveland, he teams up with Kyrie and Kevin Love. In the first series, that Celtics series, Kevin Love gets his shoulder dislocated, out for the rest of the playoffs. In overtime of game one of the finals against the Warriors, Kyrie fractures his left kneecap, out for the rest of the finals. So LeBron's got to go to war against that Warriors team with Tristan Thompson and Timofey Mozgov in the front court, and Iman Shumpert and Matthew Dellavedova with J.R. Smith off the bench. But like the starting five is like two shooters and two big guys. So so LeBron looks at it and is like, what's my only path to victory here? It's like, make sure the Warriors can't run, slow this thing down to like dinosaur pace, and just try to like bulldoze my way into the paint, play out of the post, draw the attention, kick out for shooters, or get the ball on the rim so that my bigs can offensive rebound. I have to play like glacially paced basketball in this really brutalizing way, and it's the only chance I've got. And they go and they win the next two games where both teams score fewer than 100 points. And there's like, oh my God, they might really do it before the Warriors, figure some things out and are able to win three straight. But like in that series, LeBron, including the plays where he passed out of a post-up, 9.8 post-ups per game. In this series so far against Houston, 9.5 of them, including the ones where he passes out. So like stylistic, it's so funny to see, like, we hear that a lot about guys who are veterans in the league, where it's like, well, they can't throw anything at him that he hasn't seen already. Obviously, LeBron, given the length of his career, that's not just true in terms of game plan. It's true in terms of like series script too. Okay, you take my two best complementary offensive players out of here, the other guys who can create shots for me. Oh, I literally did that in the finals 11 years ago. So like we are seeing a return to form, and the fact that he's able to do that while continuing to produce for himself, while continuing to hit the glass, while continuing to be able to like marshal this offense and like use the pieces around him to their best effect. Like Luke Kennard has been a postseason minus everywhere else he's been, and now he looks like he can't miss. Marcus Smart was in like the hinterlands of the NBA for a few years, and now it's like, oh right, that guy was a key part of a finals team. It turns out that even this deep into the game, LeBron is still able to elevate those guys and have, find out like what is the straightest path to a win for us. And even if the win probability is pretty low with it, execute that to a super high level. And now we've got a series that I think everybody projected going in without Luka, without Austin Reeves, was like the Rockets have a chance to romp here and then like take care of business quickly. Now it's looking very much the other way around. Like, oh man, could the Lakers get this done quickly and give themselves even more time to rest up and get healthy? And then what does it look like if you go into round two with a healthy and rested Luka and Austin Reeves? Like things get really interesting from there. And, LeBron's been making it really interesting for, as you said, longer than most of the guys he's posting up have been alive.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, think about it. I mean, if Jabari Smith is 22, let's say he's doing the math here. He was born in 2004, which means he was in diapers basically when he went against the Sacramento Kings in opening night in 2003. When in 2007, he was, this is crazy. In 2007, when LeBron went to the NBA Finals, these guys were like in preschool, elementary school, and he's still doing this. He's still taking teams well beyond expectation. Going into the series, I didn't pick the Lakers. I didn't know that Kevin Durant was going to miss game one, for sure. But I think going into this, I want to say the Houston Rockets were favored in game two, even with Kevin Durant. And so the fact that LeBron is doing this opposite a guy who very clearly is limited when you are doubling him. Like 9 turnovers for Kevin Durant, oftentimes off of those doubles when he's got the ball in his hands. And it is a juxtaposition. You have a 41-year-old LeBron James going against Kevin Durant, and one guy is able to navigate this scenario where they, you know, Kevin Durant's shorthanded too. Let's not gloss over the fact that he's been playing without a ball handler all season, and Fred VanVleet, an elite scorer in Fred VanVleet, and no Steven Adams, who was a key piece for them. So Kevin Durant is out here after a knee injury trying to rescue this team, and doubles in the NBA are so hard to execute and pass out to the right place. It's a lot easier when you don't have Reed Shepard out there. More on that maybe later. But for Kevin Durant, he's seeing bodies and he's seeing ghosts. It is not great for Kevin Durant right now. 9 turnovers in game 2. And the way that the chessboard, you talk about the queen on the chessboard for LeBron James operating in the post, it looks like J.J. Redick is putting Ime Udoka in checkmate all the time. And it's just the lineups, the rotations, the substitution patterns for Ime Udoka have not made a lot of sense. They just don't have the shooters. And every time they switch on to Amen Thompson or Tari Eason, LeBron's just like, I'm just going to take you down into the paint and I'm going to either hit this fadeaway or I'm going to go through you at the rim. And it's not electric efficiency, but it's enough against the Houston Rockets defense that was well above average in the regular season. And if I had told you, like, they're up 2-0 in the series against the Houston Rockets, I'm guessing it's probably just a lot of threes and a flurry of threes that they've been able to do. The Kyle Korver, Jordan Clarkson, just J.R. Smith just bomb away from downtown. They haven't really done that at all, Dan. Like, they have the lowest three-point rate in the playoffs. And yes, they've hit a high rate thanks to Luke Kennard and Marcus Smart. But a lot of this is just old school, beat you down, use up that time clock, and make sure that I have the fewest number of possessions because I don't have Luka and I don't have Austin Reeves. So if I don't have the sheer talent advantage that I did in the regular season and I'm 41 years old, let's slow things down here. And that's what's happening in this. And I'll point this out too. I remember sitting down with Eric Spoelstra once after the Dallas series. This was like 2012. And I had this conversation with him about how he met with LeBron James and told him, hey, we need to leverage all of your gifts. And one of those gifts is your ability to play in the post and just operate with your back to the basket. And what was conveyed to Spo is that, like, LeBron had never really done that up until mm-hmm. that point in his career, where he's always been able to see above the defense, facing the basket, and had the entire floor, the chessboard, in front of him. Having your back to the basket is a lot like, you know, have you ever tried, someone asked you, Dan, to, like, if you want to work on your brain acuity or just, like, sharpen up your brain a little bit, try brushing your teeth with your offhand. It's the same right, motion. Right. It's something you've done all your whole life, but doing it with your playing basketball with your back to the basket and not able to see the floor in the same way was a whole lot different for LeBron. And so that's why it took a little bit for him to feel comfortable in that back to the basket positioning. And so for LeBron, he's got more post-ups this postseason than Jokic, Karl Anthony Towns, and Alperen Şengün combined. This isn't just like, oh, he's doing a couple more here and there. He's doing it more than all of the other point maven or post mavens. They're doing it a little bit. LeBron's doing it at more than they have doing it collectively. So this is a huge story, and what a wrinkle that LeBron James has thrown into this series, that not only is he up 2-0, but playing this way, I feel like he's going to be fresher for the time that Luka and Austin Reeves come back.
Yeah, even with the heavy minutes load, right? If it's like, rather than playing the up-tempo 100 plus possessions a game, like slowing the game down, allowing you to operate at your own tempo out of, and like call the plays, dictate the way things work out of the post, allows for LeBron to be able to, you know, again, like, control how much energy he needs to put into every given possession. And, like, you know, we've talked about that for years. Like, there's a reason that LeBron operates at one of the slowest average speeds on the defensive end, right? It's like, it's not just because he doesn't really try. It's because he knows he has to conserve energy for where they're going to need it most. And, like, he'll accelerate on those offensive plays where he's got an opportunity to make an opportunistic block or steal. But, like, you know, he moves slow because he doesn't have to move for anybody. That's like the old, like, Paulie in Goodfellas. Like, he moved slow because he didn't have to move for anybody. He's the boss. When LeBron's in the post, he's the boss of the possession. And he also has all the answers to the test there. Like, if he's got a smaller defender on him, obviously he's able to, he's basically Karl Malone sized. He can back that guy down to the rim. If he's got a bigger defender, if it's with Şengün or with one of the other, like, taller, longer guys, all right, well, I can use my quicks to get around you. If he's like sized in a tough matchup with an Amen Thompson or maybe a Tari Eason, if he needs to get to, you know, go over that right shoulder, go to the fadeaway, that baseline fadeaway. How many times have we seen LeBron hit that exact shot? And he's already done it a few times in this series. And that's if you play him single up. If you bring a double there, you're bringing somebody from either the top of the floor, where JJ Redick and the Lakers have been really smart about stationing a shooter. Like, it's one pass away for Luke Kennard. It's one pass away for Marcus Smart. He's also been really smart and opportunistic about cutting. That's an opportunity for a Jackson Hayes or a DeAndre Ayton to make a quick rim run, or, you know, get a seal on whoever the rotating defender is and then play at the basket that way. When he's up on the top of the floor, you bring a defender at him, the quick hit after he's had some success in the pick and roll, then he sees the whole floor. He sees all of his potential opportunities, and nobody in the world has been better for years at that cross-court pass to the corner. I think Rui Hachimura got a three out of that last night. And you see, like, the difference in the way he operates in those positions versus the way Durant operates in those positions. And it doesn't mean, like, Kevin Durant's not as good or whatever. You know, it's not like a dramatic ding on Kevin Durant's offensive game. You know, spoiler alert, I think he's pretty good on offense. Mm-hmm. But he's never been the same, like, level of processor, kind of court vision, and speed of being able to process those things, download them, make the quick decision as LeBron does. And, like, on top of that, the Lakers also have way more shooting around him than Kevin Durant has around him in Houston. And so all of those things, you know, the edges in the other playmakers and the guards' ability to do something with the ball once they get it, the ability for LeBron to diagnose and download and immediately make the highest impact decision there, all of that goes into what's built this 2-0 lead. And now we put ourselves in position where, yeah, you see this, the stat on the screen here, LeBron James team has never lost a playoff series when up 2-0. And that's, it's a wild stat. It is an indicative of the dominance that he held over the Eastern Conference for so long. And it's also an indication that, like, when you give him a little bit, if he sees the finish line, he's exceptionally good at sprinting through the tape. And he's now halfway there in this series and a lot closer than I think a lot of us expected he would be at this point before it all tipped off.
LeBron James, among 78 players who have played at least 25 minutes a game this season, this postseason, he ranks 78th out of 78 in average speed, 3.44 miles per hour. Average speed on offense, LeBron James, out of 78 players with at least 25 minutes per game, he ranks 76th. Offensive speed. But defensive speed, he's also 78th by a mile. No pun intended. But 3.19 miles per hour. Go on your treadmill and hit the three. That's his average speed on the floor defensively. Now, he's sprinting when he needs to, like you said, but he's also preserving his energy. There are no other 41-year-olds in the playoffs, and certainly none that are going for double pump reverse dunks in the half court, getting out in transition. It's insane. It's insane. So the reason why he's posting up so much is, yeah, there's a tactical advantage, but also there's a stamina advantage. And the reason why he's able to do those double pumps, yes, he's LeBron James, but also because he's not running around and having to chase off of pin downs or anything like that. He is conserving his energy, and he's doing this more intelligently than we've ever seen before. So a lot of surprises here. I did not see the Lakers going up 2-0, even though they had home court advantage in these two. Didn't see Kevin Durant getting injured, obviously. That was a surprise. But there's a lot of surprises here, Dan, in the postseason so far. Only been a couple games for every series after it wraps up tonight. The Wednesday games wrap up tonight. We're only two games in. But still, there's a lot of crazy storylines happening. In the B block today, we're going to talk about a lot of those surprises. Wemby, the Sixers splitting it with in Boston, and also this Minnesota-Denver series. We'll also talk the series that you're boots on the ground for, Hawks, Knicks. So got lots of surprises to go through here the rest of the show. But man, LeBron dialing back the clock and playing post-up more than any other team in the NBA is nuts, and doing it in winning fashion, up 2-0 against the Houston Rockets. We'll talk more about the playoffs coming up after the break. All right, Dan, this week's big number is 16. That's the number of post-ups that LeBron James has already done in two games. He averaged like 2.6 in the regular season. He's averaging 8 now, so about 3 times as much as he did in the regular season. That's some old school, old man basketball right there, and it's very winning. So, Dan, what's your first little number here on the other series in the playoffs?
Yeah, we're going to look at 3 of the 1-1 series here in the little numbers. And our first little number goes back to that sort of size advantage, old man game basketball. First little number this week is 34%. That was the Portland Trailblazers' offensive rebounding rate in Game 2 on Tuesday night, according to Cleaning the Glass. In Game 1, Portland rebounded 26% of its own misses. And that gap between 34% and 26%, that's the difference between top 5 offensive rebounding rate and bottom 5 offensive rebounding rate. 23 second chance points for the Blazers in Game 2, up from 13 in Game 1. And I think that points to the big story coming out of Game 2 of Spurs-Blazers, with all due respect to Scoot Henderson, who had like the game of his career, which was wonderful to see given how, you know, many hardships he's had to deal with and how difficult his first couple of years have been. But the big story coming out of Game 2 of Spurs-Blazers was Victor Wembanyama suffering a concussion. Suffered a nasty fall after being fouled on a drive with about 9 minutes to go in the second quarter. Landed hard on his face. If I close my eyes, it's because I don't really want to see this replay again, but we are showing it to you in journalistic responsibility. He was very clearly in serious pain and really dazed, stumbled getting up, went back to the locker room, was ruled out from there, and then put into the concussion protocol, the league's concussion protocol, which means he can't return to full participation in basketball activities for 48 hours. He can resume gradual activities in 24 hours only if his symptoms aren't getting worse. And then he has to hit several different benchmarks before a team doctor and a league protocol director can clear him to play, all of which puts his status for the remainder of this series in some doubt. You know, even the quickest potential return here is a few days down the line, and the series is about to shift back to Portland for Game 3. So we talk about we talked about this last week as we sort of headed into this matchup, the idea that the presence of Victor Wembanyama in the post or in the paint could dictate how effective Denny Avdia could be at his downhill drives. It could dictate how effectively Donovan Klingon and Robert Williams III and all those crashing guards could get to the offensive glass. And you know how like the Blazers have built their offense this season on rim pressure and hammer in the glass. Without Wembanyama there, you kind of got to like your chances if you're the Blazers coming out of that 1-1 and then with so much uncertainty in front of you.
Yeah, an incredible performance in Game 2, Wemby or not. Again, on Wemby, there's nothing we can really, the tea leaves we can look at here with the injury, of course, from Jeff Stotts. The average time loss for a concussion is a little under 10 days. Median, meaning some of that data is skewed by someone who might have missed, you know, 2 months due to a concussion. So the median day time loss due to injury is 7. So 7 days, a week for a concussion. But again, as he points out, there's a lot of variability when you talk about a brain injury like this. Victor Wembanyama, also someone who is not your average size. And so for him, I don't know if the height matters all that much. I'm not a doctor. I'm certainly not a neurologist, but I would imagine that when you have someone as important as Victor Wembanyama to your franchise, I think on one hand, the fans will probably be like, I want him back for Game 3 no matter what. And I think the Spurs might take it as this is about Game 300, right? Game 3000. We want him to be as ready for the long haul as anything. That's the number one thing, is his long-term health. And I think the Spurs will do everything in their power to make sure he's going to be 100% healthy when he comes back with that injury. Now, you said it. They took advantage. The Blazers, all season long, have been one of the best, if not the best, offensive rebounding team. The reason why we look at offensive rebound rate of 34% is the Blazers are not a great shooting team. They're going to get a lot of offensive rebounds just by virtue. There's a lot of offensive rebound opportunities that they're not making those shots, right? So what you do is you look at offensive rebound rates, which is essentially the percentage of available offensive rebounds. How well did you actually recover those boards? And so for the Blazers at 34%, that's a really good number, not just because they miss a lot of shots in the regular season. They were able to say, hey, look, if we're not the best shooting team, let's at least get Donovan Kling and Tamani Kamara, Rob Williams to crash the boards and get those second chance opportunities. And not just get those second chance opportunities, Dan, it's to make the most of those. The Blazers love to hit dagger threes, as they call it, which is hitting a three after the offensive rebound. And it's a big reason why the Blazers average 115 points every possession when they got the offensive rebound. Compare that 115 figure to the San Antonio Spurs, who also got a bunch of offensive rebounds in this game, but they did not capitalize in ways that maybe would help to have a 7'4" guy out on the floor to help you convert those second chance opportunities. The Blazers have a really big dude in the middle, two of them, Rob Williams and Donovan Kling, and two of the best. I don't think Rob Williams got enough credit this season for how well he was defensively, offensively, stretching the floor, hitting threes, something he did in game two that a lot of people are surprised at. If you weren't paying attention to the Blazers this season, Rob Williams might have been the most underrated bench player in the league. I think he deserved a lot more credit, sixth man of the year conversation, because of the way he stabilized those second units. And because Donovan Klingon started just about every game this year, you didn't get to see a lot of Rob Williams out there, but he was so essential to how the Blazers played and dealt with all those injuries. They had the third most games lost due to injury. Not Rob Williams. That guy typically is the guy who's banged up, but this year, awesome season and awesome game two, and a big reason why you see the Blazers splitting it and knotting it up at one going back to Portland. So, Dan, the offensive rebounding, Scoot Henderson's, the shot is looking so good. The mid-range, really they're giving him the mid-range, and he's taking it. I didn't think this season he was going to be able to get all the way back pre-injury, but he's doing that and more in a time of need when they're against the San Antonio Spurs on the road in a very, that is a tough environment to play in for a guy his age. And he's been playing the best basketball of his career. Tiago Splitter has been doing an awesome job, but this team is built to take advantage of those second chance opportunities, kick out to those three pointers. And you can't ask for a better performance than what you got in game two.
Yeah, and while Wembanyama is going to be the headline there and certainly was here for us, like, credit where it's due. The Blazers absolutely earned that win. Like, even, you know, Luke Kornet played fantastic when he got when he came in as the sub for Victor Wembanyama. The Blazers were down, I believe, 13 with about 8 minutes left in this game and just walked the Spurs down. And they did it with defense, which has been the story of the Blazers all season long. I believe it was a 24-10 run over the last 8 minutes of the game. The Spurs 3-for-15 from the floor with a pair of turnovers during that period. So obviously, if you're the Spurs and Victor Wembanyama is not going to be available, much more will be required of De'Aaron Fox, who struggled with the length that Portland brought on the perimeter. Stephon Castle, Devin Vassell had a really nice game and had a chance to win it with a really nice look at the final seconds there. Phenomenal shot contest by Matisse Thybulle in the quarter to contest without fouling and make that a tough shot that Vassell still almost knocked in. But that crunch time offense, when you don't have to have Victor to be able to orient it around, maybe as big an issue as the defensive part too. So a lot to figure out there. And, you know, certainly the health of Victor Wembanyama paramount among it and what that means for the interior battle on both sides. Let's go from the interior to outside. Our second little number this week is 15. That is how many more three-pointers the Philadelphia 76ers made in game two against the Boston Celtics than they made in game one. Game one in Boston on the weekend, Sixers went 4-for-23 from deep. In game two on Tuesday night, they went 19-for-39. In a related story, they got blown out in game one and they won game two. They took a game in Boston to take home court advantage in that best of seven series. Coming out of game one, Nick Nurse, the head coach of the Sixers, was adamant they needed to generate more threes. That's the underdog strategy, right? You are against a heavily favored team. You've got to up the variance, jack up the three-point rate. Give yourself more opportunities to get more points on fewer possessions. Game one, 26.5% of their shot attempts came from beyond the arc. No team in the NBA where it was under 30% for the regular season. So like sub-basements below, lowest in the league in game one. Game two, 42% of them were triples, and that would be a top five rate during the regular season. And that variance, that gap, is real. It's like what you have to be able to bring to bear against a team as good as Boston when you are as shorthanded as the Sixers are without Joel Embiid. VJ Edgecombe, absolute nails. That, talk about a young guy with a shot looking great for him too. Like 30 points in the postseason, I believe 30 and 10, youngest guy since Magic Johnson to do that, I think was the stat last night. Absolutely ridiculous. The way they were generating them too, I think that was the interesting part. 18 of the Sixers' 39 threes were pull-ups. It was off the bounce, dribble three-point shots. They made eight of them. Both of those tied a season high for a single game for the Sixers. And when you think about pull-up threes, you think about Tyrese Maxey, the way he's rejecting those screens, creating space, stepping back, and he was nails in the fourth quarter to put the Celtics down. I think, you know, we hear it every game basically at this point in the NBA. It's make or miss league, right? And it's easy to say that gap, Boston was plus 42 at the three-point line in game one, and they were minus 18 in game two. There's the variance, right? There's the swing. I think the question is like, is this something that you have to be worried about if you're Joe Mazzulla and the Celtics, or is this blip on the radar? This can happen sometimes. We get back to it and we're not too concerned.
I think it was Earl Weaver who said momentum is just the next day's starting pitcher.
Right. And
it's momentum is a finicky thing in the NBA. I don't believe that there's game to game momentum. I think a lot of it is just make or miss and a lot of the shot variance, but there was strategy involved in this one where it looked like Joe Mazzulla was playing drop coverage and just daring the Philadelphia 76ers to shoot. And they were willing shooters. So Nick Nurse played to the strength and basically saying, yeah, I know we didn't do this enough in game one, but I think we can do a whole lot better. And that shot variance saved them in this. And let's just talk about it. The Boston Celtics, when they're not hitting those shots, it's ugly basketball. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing when they come down, low turnover basketball, hoisting up a lot of threes. They shot 13 of 50 in this one, missed 37 threes. And when you're talking about league-wide, the three-point rate, the three-point field goal percentage is down this year from about 36% down to 34%. It's early this postseason compared to last season. But that's something that I'm going to be watching is defense travels, shot variance will not. So a lot of the 3-point shooting variance that you're going to see from game to game is going to be, it's not going to be very predictable, but for the defense for the Celtics, you can control a lot more about how many threes your opponents take compared to whether it goes in or not. And study after study has proven this out, that defenses can control the opponent volume way better than whether it goes in or not. So when you're talking about the defensive strategy that Joe Mazzulla employed in game two, a lot of times they were almost letting the Sixers shoot those and saying like, yeah, we're going to trust that they're not going to go in. But ultimately, VJ Edgecombe does not care for those strategies. He is going to hit those shots. And same with Tyrese Maxey, who's as good of a three-point shooter as you'll find in the long run in the league. So the Sixers, I think if they get the looks that they had in game two, I kind of think, Dan, that you're going to see an adjustment from Joe Mazzulla in game three to not let them get so many open threes.
I think a couple of interesting things about that. One, if you're going to play that drop, you can't do it against Maxey because he has, I think, only six guys in the NBA made more pull-up threes than him this season. He is going to take that shot every chance he sees it. Everybody else in the Sixers, you can understand the math on it. No other great pull-up three-point shooters on that roster. But Maxey, he's going to light that on fire. Then as far as the adjustment, like we saw this against the Knicks in the second round last year, right? Where if you were going purely based on shot quality modeling, the Celtics were fine. And then all of a sudden they were down 0-2 and their offense had completely bogged down against the Knicks switching in the first two games of that series. And then they were playing from underneath. And so it's a question of like Joe Mazzulla, I don't think really did feel like he had to adjust too much. He was like, yeah, it'll work out in the wash. And then before you knew it, they were behind the eight ball. So I think it'll be interesting to see if he feels compelled to dramatically shift what they're doing. Because again, yeah, you look at the shot quality numbers and it's like Boston dramatically outperformed its shot quality in game one. Philly underperformed it. the reverse is true in game two, and then all of a sudden you got a 1-1 series. So it's not exactly, I will grant, brilliant analysis to say make more threes equals good, but sometimes that's where we get left in the middle of a 1-1 series. Brings us to our third and final little number. We'll go back inside for this one. Third and final little number this week is 35.3, which is Nikola Jokic's field goal percentage when guarded by Rudy Gobert through two games of the opening round series between Denver and Minnesota, according to NBA.com's matchup data. And sometimes that counts like partial possessions that they were guarding each other or be matched up. So it's not exactly, you know, 100% gospel, but back of the envelope math, we'll go with it here. On possessions where Gobert has been the guy with the matchup, Jokic, 6-for-17 from the field, 15 points, 10 assists, 5 turnovers, 1 shooting foul drawn. Against everybody else in a Wolves uniform, Jokic is 14-for-21, 36 points, 9 assists, 3 turnovers, 3 shooting fouls drawn. So against everybody else, making 2/3 of his shots, against Rudy, barely more than 1/3. And this is interesting because it's a shift in the way that the Wolves were guarding Jokic, right? Like, they kind of wrote the blueprint, to the extent that there is a blueprint for guarding Nikola Jokic, they kind of wrote it in those first two playoff series between these two teams, one Denver 1-5, and then one famously Minnesota 1-7. And the idea was like Towns on Jokic with Gobert behind. And then we saw that happen again last year with the Thunder, right? Where it's like, we're going to have Hartenstein up front, but we're going to have Chet behind, or we're going to flip it, always a guy behind, and have like two layers of 7-footers bracketing Jokic, essentially. And now you don't have Karl-Anthony Towns in Minnesota anymore. You've got Julius Randle, who's several inches shorter, and Naz Reid, who's several inches shorter, and Jokic can just kind of put those guys in the basket or shoot over the top of them. So Rudy has to be the frontline defender on Jokic, and it's kind of working, right? Like, it's in, maybe like, it's interesting. You can argue it is, you can argue it isn't. On one hand, when Jokic and Gobert have been on the floor together, Denver's winning those minutes. Plus 12 in 51 minutes through two games. And obviously all these samples are small, but the playoffs are a small sample size. Deal with it. So they're winning those minutes, but they're winning them with defense. In those minutes, the Jokic and Gobert on the floor together minutes, Denver's got a 106.4 offensive rating, which is like galaxies below their league-leading offensive efficiency. It's so far below it. And so Rudy's doing what they need him to do. Denver's won the minutes, but sort of the it seems to be like Minnesota's won the war a little bit through two games. Again, they get one on the road, they get home court advantage, and they look like they've got something to work off of here. Or maybe they don't. Maybe it's a blip. What do you think? Do you think that being able to guard Gobert on Jokic one-on-one is going to be a workable strategy for Minnesota moving forward?
Well, I think it's one thing to focus on the field goal percentage when guarded by Gobert, and the trade-off that you do there is like if he's not scoring, Jokic can beat you in multiple ways, right? So
sure,
this is like one of the things
we talked about with LeBron, like, right? Yeah,
yeah, it's like how the greatest offensive talents we've ever seen pick up a basketball for this reason is that even if you are going to hold Nikola Jokic to 35% shooting, there's still this whole other thing where how are his teammates doing? Because he's going to hit his guys and create plays for others. And that's what makes it so hard guarding Nikola Jokic or LeBron James or Luka Doncic, whomever it is, that is always constantly making plays for others. In the regular season, Nikola Jokic got an assist on 61% of his potential assists, meaning when he created a shot for others that the player tracking cameras are picking up, when he creates a shot for others that would be considered an assist for him if they made the basket, usually that converted at 61% he would get the assist, meaning that the guy hit the shot. In this postseason, it's down to 47%, which you can read as the teammates are not doing their job. Jokic is doing their job. He had 17 potential assists per game in the regular season. In the postseason, that's at 20.5, meaning he's passing a lot more because he's got Rudy Gobert behind him. He's trying to hit his teammates to get open shots. They're not converting. And so in the little like chess versus checkers of this, I think if you're the Nuggets, you feel like in the long run, as long as he can continue getting his teammates open shots, those shots will start to fall. But as we talked about with the Boston Celtics, this isn't a game to a series of infinity. This is a 7-game series in which you've got to win 3 more games now than your opponent before they do. And you might not get that variance to fall back down to earth. And before you know it, that 35% field goal percentage matters a whole lot more than whether the teammates are hitting their shots. Because right now, the Denver Nuggets are not hitting at a high rate. And because everything runs through Jokic, that's a huge problem.
And it's also just the impact of not needing to throw 2 bodies at him means a Jaden McDaniels can stay at home on Jamal Murray. It means Anthony Edwards is able to stay locked up on the perimeter. The other guys that are out there, the Ayo Dosunmus and the Dante DiVincenzos and everybody else, is able to play a little more physical chest to chest out on the perimeter without having to dig down as hard. And that is going to mean some of those, like if your closeout's a half step closer, you're maybe able to get a better contest on that kick out. And maybe the likelihood of that going in drops because of that. And so like, I think it's fascinating to me that the best way anybody had figured out how to guard this guy involved Gobert being back off of him. And now that that's not a feasible answer for Denver, for Minnesota rather, it's just, we'll put him on him. And then you get the reminders of like, oh, right, there's a reason this guy's a 4-time defensive player of the year. And, you know, he's going to, the highlight reels of him getting sauced up on the perimeter in Utah are never going to go away from him. Just like no one's ever going to forget that Mikal Bridges got traded for 5 first-round picks. That's the things we're going to remember. But there's also been a lot more quiet excellence over a much longer period of time. And I think we're seeing some more of that right now. Whether it persists or not, it got Minnesota 1 in Denver, which is an awfully tough place to do that, and puts the Wolves in position to maybe wrest control of this series as it shifts back to the Twin Cities for Game 3. So split series, favorites losing, home teams giving away home court advantage. It's been pretty interesting. Not in LA, evidently, but maybe just about everywhere else in the NBA postseason world so far.
Yeah. Father Time has not come for LeBron James, also has not come for CJ McCollum. Holy cow. We're going to talk about CJ McCollum, the MSG villain, what he's been doing in this series, and how he was able to pull off what seemed like the impossible, is going into MSG and after a huge deficit down the stretch, stealing a win from New York. So here we're going to talk about that after the break. Dan, you were there, so I can't wait to ask you about what you're seeing in that series. They're doing Trae Young sucks chants, or chanting out Trae Young, profanities in Madison Square Garden. He's not even there. But CJ McCollum is, Jalen Johnson is, Nickeil Alexander-Walker. They're all there. And it's an amazing testament to, hey, I'm going to go and find these tanking teams and pilfer their talent. Because the Lakers were able to get Marcus Smart from the Wizards after they waived Marcus Smart, and they were able to get the Atlanta Hawks were able to get CJ McCollum, who was awesome in Game 2. And really, for the second half of the season, McCollum has been pacing one of the best offenses in the league, if not the best offense in the league, depending on where you put the sliders. And maybe we didn't do enough talking about how the Hawks had a potential to upset the New York Knicks going into Game 2 and stealing this one. Down big late, CJ McCollum just putting on a clinic and getting buckets in ways that we've watched over the years. CJ McCollum has as good of a bag as anybody. But at this stage of his career, I think a lot of people doubted whether this was just a salary dump to just try to get off of Trae Young. And the Atlanta Hawks got CJ McCollum, but man, how much can you ask of him at this stage of his career? Well, how about this? Stealing a game in Madison Square Garden. Dan, you must have been as surprised as I was watching this game that the Hawks were able to steal this one in Madison Square Garden.
You know, I'm as surprised as somebody who has to write a takeaways column for Shortly After the Buzzer can be when you have to select all,
that's the
erase,
worst, man.
And then start rewriting. But hey, it's what it is. This is on... On one level, yes, surprise in that, you know, the Knicks seem to have this game pretty well in hand through 3 quarters, double-digit lead entering the fourth quarter. And the Hawks had just really not been especially in the second half of game one and then through the first three quarters of game two, that like their offense had really not been able to do very much outside of CJ McCollum able to, you know, get downhill, get to some you know, pull-ups and floaters and things. But like Josh Hart doing a really excellent job on Jalen Johnson, OG Anunoby cross-matching onto Onyeka Okongwu so that Karl Anthony Towns can sag off of Dyson Daniels and that kind of gumming up the works. You know, Nickeil Alexander-Walker dealing with the length and ability to get through screens of Mikal Bridges. So like the offense just really hadn't been clicking for the Hawks. And it seemed like they weren't going to be able to score enough, frankly. And then it all really flipped on a dime. And like the Knicks, you know, we talked about the offensive collapse for San Antonio where they went, you know, I think 10 points in the final 7 or 8 minutes and things just, you know, missed shot after missed shot, turnover, getting, allowing for runouts. You saw so much of that in this down the stretch for the Knicks as well. And so on one level, surprised because that was not what the run of play looked like. On the other hand, though, not particularly surprising because almost a year to the day, I watched almost this exact game happen in Knicks Pistons game two of the first round last year, where the Knicks looked like they had things pretty well in hand. Then they, the offense gets bogged down, gummed up, partially due to, again, a cross match on the other side of the floor where the Pistons were putting a wing defender on Karl Towns. It was Tobias Harris in that series. And then having Jalen Duren roam off of Josh Hart, seeing that in this series with Okongwu on Hart and Jonathan Kuminga roaming off of, Kuminga on Towns, bodying him up and then sort of taking him out of the play. The Knicks starting to go mismatch hunting with Brunson, saying he's going to bring Hart into the place so we can go at Okongwu. He's going to bring Bridges up to set the screen so we can try to go at CJ McCollum. And then just like the offense getting stuck in the mud. I watched this exact thing happen almost a year ago. And so a surprise on one level, a pretty familiar script on the other side of it. Maybe the bigger surprise being like the Knicks don't have a better answer for this at this point, a year down the line after seeing a season full of this matchup, this sort of matchup rather. But I think the big thing, as you mentioned, for the Hawks is like they know they've got a button they can push. And that button is we will bring Jalen Brunson into the action and CJ McCollum is going to go take the, you know, have him dance. Through two games so far, when CJ McCollum has Jalen Brunson on him, 9 for 12 from the field with 4 assists. So he is getting whatever he wants out of that matchup. And Christian Winfield of the New York Daily News asked CJ in his postgame presser, like, seemed like you kind of felt comfortable in that matchup. You know, are you liking what you see when you get Jalen on him? And CJ just like deadpan eyeballed him and said, what do you think? And Christian Winfield said, yeah. And CJ McCollum goes, yeah. And that was the end of the press conference. He got up and walked off from there. And I was like, you know, this is pretty, you know, you can say you're not a villain. You're just a family man with a wife and two kids. But the look that he gave Christian Winfield when he answered that question, what do you think? Yeah, I feel pretty good about what I'm getting in that matchup. I think the Hawks certainly feel good about what they're getting when they're able to put Jalen Brunson into action. And the Knicks are going to need to come up with some answers for it moving back to Atlanta.
Did you ever look at Basketball Reference, what CJ stands for? It says it right here.
No, I don't.
It says Cooking Jalen. Yeah. It's weird.
You should feel proud about that. I like that you laughed at your own joke on that because you should feel good. You deserve to feel good about that.
Look, I'm a father. I'm allowed to laugh at my own dad jokes.
That's right. That's exactly right. Hey, just like CJ McCollum, you're a family man. You can laugh at your own jokes when they tickle you. That's totally fine.
Man, Quinn Snyder, the Atlanta Hawks, they got to feel awesome about what they just did to the Knicks. The Knicks were supposed to be this high powered offense with guys who've played together forever. And they just got cooked by a guy who just came over in a trade 2 months ago with the Atlanta Hawks and a team that had played up until this point with a very ball dominant Trae Young and having to learn the offense on the fly with Jalen Johnson at the reins. And of course you have Nickeil Alexander-Walker coming over from Minnesota last year. And this is going to be the story of the postseason for the New York Knicks is, has this group reached the end of its line? You know, do they need to shake things up with this starting five? Or is this a case where they just had a bad game and we want to read too much into it? But I know that if the Hawks upset the New York Knicks, there are going to be changes in New York. There just has to be. we can't have another run with this group together playing as much as they've had together and still not getting over the hump. And yes, they went to the conference finals last year, but they lost to the Indiana Pacers and they were favored. You know, the Knicks were favored in that series. And we got to say, like, the offense with Jalen Brunson as being the head of that snake, it was not enough to overcome this. According to All City NBA, the tough defensive game for Brunson, the Hawks got 1.77 points per direct drive tonight when Brunson was guarding the ball handler. That's the sixth worst mark for a defender who guarded at least 14 drives in a game this season. Okay, there's two things I want to point out there in that stat. One is, 1.77 is a lot of points. I mean, that's a 177 offensive rating in that situation. But guarded at least 14 times. That means he has been targeted, you know? So in a selection bias of there's a lot of possessions that he's being targeted defensively. And even among those targeted defensively matchups, he's sixth worst. So you're going to get some really bad defensive ratings in that group when you're being targeted that much, at least 14 in a game. And so even among that really wretched pool of defenders, he's sixth worst. And it couldn't come at a worse time for them in this game where they go up 2-0 going into Atlanta. They're feeling a whole lot differently. So, Dan, do you feel differently about, you know, projecting this series? Or do you think the Hawks found something? Or do you feel like, hey, if you picked Atlanta or New York winning in 6 or 7, you knew that you're baking in a game like this for the Atlanta Hawks?
Yeah, I think that I think I had Knicks in 6 before the series, so that is going to require 2 Hawks wins somewhere along the line. Having watched these Knicks up close over the last couple of seasons, it seemed likely one of them would come in Madison Square Garden because the Knicks have had a tendency to drop games in the Garden. They did it against the Heat a couple of years ago. They did it against the Pistons last year. They did it against the Pacers last year. They did it against the Celtics after winning 2 games in Boston. So like it happens. And I think the challenge or the thing that you should feel or that I think you would feel less than stellar about for the Knicks is the things that are happening are not something that you couldn't have imagined before the series. Like, I'm an idiot and I saw the cross match onto Towns coming, right? Like, it was pretty easy to see. Whether it was going to be Dyson Daniels or it was going to be Jonathan Kuminga or it was going to be Jalen Johnson, they were going to go to that because if you guard Towns with your 5, he's going to cook you as he did to the Hawks throughout the regular season when they had Onyeka Okongwu on them. I think the interesting thing has been that Quinn Snyder's kind of gone back and forth with it. He stuck, played for most of game 1 with Okongwu straight on Towns, and then in the last 5 minutes, last 5 or 6 minutes rather, he put Daniels onto Towns, and Towns basically receded from view, was not used as the screener. And that was when the Hawks kind of made their late run, too little too late, but put that in the memory banks, right? He comes out to start game 2. Snyder has the matchups crossed up with Daniels on Towns, shows it for a little bit, but then backs off of it. Partially because he wants to have Daniels on Jalen Brunson. And the interesting part of that is like he's picking him up full court. He's dogging him the full 94. Yeah, Brunson's able to get off every now and again to get the shots that he wants. But as we talked about throughout last postseason, teams like the Pacers, teams like the Thunder, they bring you that full court pressure and there's the wear down effect, right? What are we seeing in the fourth quarter of this playoff so far? Brunson's 3 for 11 in the fourth quarter through 2 games. And I think that's interesting, especially given that he's able to call the ball, right? He dials up, what are we going to run on this possession? Who am I bringing up to screen? What are we trying to get out of it? And if you have a version of Jalen Brunson, he was a clutch player of the year last year. We've seen so many of these great late game shots where he's able to cook in isolation, get to his mid-range, create space, and then throw in a tough shot. When those shots go in, more often than not, the Knicks win. When they don't, the offense can be really difficult and stagnant to come by. And other guys aren't getting into a rhythm when they're not touching the ball. And if those misses, if he's below the foul line and he's missing that shot, it's an opportunity for a defensive rebound and a run out the other way. And you had the Hawks getting, run out layup after run out layup. I think they were had 22 points in the paint in the fourth quarter of game 2. And like that was where they were able to make either breaking down Brunson off the dribble with CJ and then a couple times Kuminga muscling him up. in the half court on a cross match, but then also getting out in transition off of those defensive rebounds and some late turnovers. And so this is the recipe for how things go badly for the Knicks. And so, and it can just as easily break the other way. Throughout Jalen Brunson's tenure in New York, when he's had one of these kind of games, he has tended to, you know, in the break between them, sort of download it, figure out what he needs to do, and then adjust after that. Like, I'm remembering again in the Sixers series a couple years ago, the length they were putting on him on the ball with Nick Batum and Kelly Oubre. He was having a really hard time finding his range, getting to where he, you know, his spots, and he's missing a lot of shots. And then he absolutely exploded once the series went back to Philly and had a couple of 40-point games for the rest of that series. It would not shock me in the least if a similar kind of dam bursting was coming there. But I think Brunson also needs to be aware of when he's putting the cape on in those late game situations, everybody else is getting, you know, frosty waiting for their opportunities. And that can have kind of a compounding effect on that offense. So yeah, like, I don't necessarily think this changes the fundamentals of the matchup. The Knicks still have a significant talent advantage. They have got the size advantage they were able to leverage in the offensive rebounding game in game two. They've got a depth advantage that I think maybe Mike Brown might believe a little too much in. If you know, you might want to mothball the no Brunson, no Cat lineups at the start of the second and fourth quarters, because those were kind of tough. Yeah. But I think, you know, the on paper reasons to believe in the Knicks, I think, persist. But the game ain't played on paper, and CJ McCollum is pretty confident in what he can get out of that matchup. The Hawks are confident in what they're bringing to the table. They feel like we're not going to get those same kind of rough games from Jalen Johnson and Nikhil Alexander Walker. Those guys are going to play back up to their standard back at home. And if they do that two times, the Knicks are in real, real trouble.
Yeah. On that note, the Knicks in the fourth quarter this season, 116 points every 100 possessions, one of the best in the league in the fourth quarter. In this series against the Atlanta Hawks, it goes from 116 to 95. So a huge drop off when the lights are brightest at Madison Square Garden. So Mike Brown has got a lot of work to do to figure out, because he can't take Jalen Brunson off the floor in those fourth quarters. Got to figure out a way to minimize the damage defensively. And that's always the thing with the Becky Hammon comments, is like, if you got a guy that small leading your offense and being so important offensively, you got to make up for it defensively in a way to mitigate those losses and the damage on that end. And it's a big reason why the Atlanta Hawks got off of Trae Young. Jalen Brunson's a much better offensive player than Trae Young. But I would say that they have the same sort of, Quinn Snyder had the same sort of problem that he had to solve, is how do I make up for this deficiency on the defensive end so it doesn't cost us a series? And for Quinn Snyder, he doesn't have to deal with that anymore. But now the Knicks still have to figure out how to keep Jalen Brunson on the floor and making magic down the stretch without getting exploited on the other end. Any last thoughts here on Knicks Hawks before we end this thing?
Famous last words from Josh Hart. It was asked about, like, what part of the game two defeat was the most frustrating. And he said, was any one part of it most frustrating to him? And he said, nah, just all of it. This was a game we should have won. And in the playoffs, you can't give away games. And like, credit to the Hawks for taking it when it was out there. But yeah, the Knicks were arguably the best fourth quarter and crunch time team in the league this season, or one of them on the short list. And it has not looked that way through two games of the playoffs. And they need to rediscover that in a big way as this series shifts back to Atlanta for Thursday night.
This isn't going to help Knicks fans, but they had a 93% chance of winning that game with 5 minutes left, up eight. So that was
not for nothing. That's pretty low in terms of win probability of games that the Knicks have blown at the Garden in the playoffs the last couple of years. So like, that's like,
You're not making them feel better, Dan.
Well, yeah. There was the the only on the scene reporting that I can give you that I haven't read anywhere else was while OG Anunoby strode to the foul line to miss a pair of free throws with about a minute and a half left in the game, a very leather lunged man from the upper deck screamed, "You're making $40 million! You're making what KD makes!" And I couldn't get that into the story, but I was like, that is a pretty good line. I mean, listen, everybody misses free throws sometimes. That was not a great time for OG Anunoby to do it. But yeah, "You're making $40 million. You make what KD makes." That's burrowed into the back of my brain.
Oh, man. The guy who had nine turnovers, that's how I would have responded.
Yeah. That's right. Fair enough.
The guy who had nine.
Maybe if OG sees that guy, yeah. Yeah.
Also, CJ missed those free throws at the end too. So, like, OG, you know what?
Yeah.
It's not just you. So I think, yeah, that's great. I'm just glad that you were able to have a medium, a platform to share that that story, yeah. You know, and get those leather yeah. lungs out there for the masses. That was a great. I didn't hear it firsthand, but I can hear it now because of your great vocals there. So thank you for that, Dan.
I'm hoping that I didn't blow out everybody, our producer's ears. I apologize if I did, but hopefully it comes near the end so you can rest up and recuperate for the next time.
That's right. Thank you to, speaking of producers, thank you to Brad and Emmy and everyone behind the scenes making the show a reality. Make sure you smash that subscribe button to our channel, Yahoo NBA. We are really excited to be doing this alongside the Dunker Spot and the Kevin O'Connor Show, which you can find all at one home at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. So go check out that channel and also subscribe to us wherever you listen to the podcast. We will be doing this again next week, next Wednesday, as we do every week here at Yahoo Sports at the Big Number. Dan, thank you so much. Everyone else, have a great rest of your week and have a great weekend.